So this whole bundle of problems I put together and under the rubric of the long emergency, a period of time that would be characterized by discontinuity, by a break between what we knew and what was normal and what our accustomed behaviors and habits and practices and expectations were and where we're heading. And a lot of it starts here, in this unfortunate place. What I used to, back in the old urban design days, I used to describe it as the national automobile slum. But now I call it something else. And by the way, that doesn't help up there. The smiling water tower doesn't help because it's not even what it's intended to be. You know, and everybody knows this subconsciously. You know, it's not Mr. Have a Nice Day. It's the face of a wrathful deity. That's what he looks like, you know, when he's not behind the veil. And he's looking down at us saying, you're a wicked people and you're going to be punished. And I'm going to begin by making you live in this. And that's what we've done, you know, and that's where we're at. And it's pretty unpleasant. No one's having a better day down there because of him. In fact, it's, you know, the whole thing is counterintuitive. It only makes people feel worse. You know, they see that, and they reach for the, you know, the Prozac, the Celexa, the Zoloft, in the down in the console of the Toyota. Anyway, you know, I stopped referring to this necessarily in urban design terms now, and now I describe it as the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world. And it's an enormous problem. You know, the reason you call it that, the reason you can say it's the greatest misallocation of resources in the history of the world is because it has no future. And we poured all of our national treasure into building an infrastructure for daily life that has no future. And all of its accessories and all of its furnishings, the strip malls, the box stores, the highways, the parking lagoons, you know, the whole ensemble. You know, we've from sea to shining sea, you know, from Florida to British Columbia, we poured our wealth into these environments, and they have no future. And unfortunately, you know, there are a lot of consequences of that. One is that it automatically provokes a psychology of previous investment, which means that, you know, having put so much of your wealth and indeed your identity into this way of life, into the equipment for running this way of life, you can't imagine changing it. You can't imagine letting go of it or giving it up. And that's probably the main reason behind the fact that we're not having a coherent conversation, a coherent public discussion about what we're going to do about these problems. And indeed, it's behind the fact that the only discussion we're really having is how we're going to prop this stuff up by other means, you know, other means than petroleum. There are additional problems that are entailed by this. One is that you know, in the 1990s, the United States basically got rid of its manufacturing economy, and then we pretended that we replaced it with something really snazzy. You know, at times we called it the information economy. And then at times we said, oh, it's a service economy. But that was all nonsense. It was really a suburban sprawl building economy. And that's what eventually was expressed in the housing bubble, you know, which was the climactic efflorescence of this activity. And what it really amounted to was devoting the last 15 years to building even more stuff that has no future. You know, a tragic behavior, a set of tragic choices. Life, you know, the truth is life is tragic. People, cultures make unhappy choices, unfortunate choices. About 40% of the jobs that were created from the 90s on in the United States were created in the housing bubble, suburban sprawl building industry. including the production home builders and the realtors and the mortgage originators and salespeople and the financiers who were packaging the mortgages into bogus securities, and the guys who were installing the granite countertops, and the developers of the furnishings and accessories, the malls and strip malls, the Home Depots, et cetera, et cetera. And if you subtract all that employment from the United States employment, what's left is hairstyling, fried chicken, and open heart surgery. And that's all. So naturally, the collapse of the housing bubble is very traumatic, because there are most of the positions in open heart surgery and fried chicken are occupied. We don't need any more of those guys. So this has been an enormous problem, and it is now unraveling in your neighbor to the south. It hasn't unraveled here yet, and one of the things that I found curious and indeed even a little disturbing was the pervasive suggestion as I was toured around Surrey a few days ago that we're different here. This wouldn't happen to us, you know. And I got a lot of kind of flashes of things out there. And one of the flashes I got out in Surrey was, you know, this is exactly what they thought in Atlanta and Phoenix 24 months ago. Oh, it's different here. This would never happen to us. And I really wonder. I got another flash out in Surrey, too, which, you know, may be of some interest to the planning and architecture community here. The interesting thing is you've done a great job, given the nature of the car-dependent culture. You know, you have done a great job out in the asteroid belt of Surrey in assembling density. But what you've done, what you've managed to do is assemble density with absolutely no artistry. You know, it's monotonous, boring, ugly, and unfortunately, I think what you're going to see as a consequence of that is a lot of people in the metro area are going to come to the conclusion that density is the problem. You know, you cannot afford to do density that is not beautiful, that does not create good public spaces, that does not include good, well-detailed streets and a few good buildings every now and again, not just production cookie-cutter stuff. And that's the big lesson from Surrey, among other things. We'll get to that in a little while. But as far as the United States goes, you know, I think the salient point is that, you know, a lot of people in the United States that are in the suburban sprawl building industry really think that we're at the bottom of a cycle, or we're nearing the bottom of a cycle, or we're heading down to the bottom of the cycle. What they don't get is it's not the cycle anymore. It's over. There's going to be no more cycles of suburban sprawl building. We're not going to build anymore, because by the time this fiasco is worked out, and it's going to take years to work it out, including figuring out who even owns the defaulted mortgages, which have been sliced and diced and dissociated and deployed as far away as the Norwegian substitute teachers union, you know, owning little pieces of McHouses in Illinois and Nevada, and oh my God, what do we do? You know, how are they going to foreclose on that stuff? You know, it's going to take forever to work this stuff out, and by that the time they do, we're going to be, we will have entered the real robust stage of the oil problem, and then it will be self-evident that we can't live like this anymore. So this is the end of that. It's not the bottom of the cycle. We're just not going to do it. There are a lot of other compelling reasons why we're not going to do this anymore. One is that any way you cut it or slice it and dice it, we're going to have some kind of problems with industrial agriculture. You know, the whole process of taking the oil-based inputs and the gas-based fertilizers and the herbicides and putting it on the soil and getting the little crops of the cheese doodles out of the ground, that's not going to be working for us anymore. And we're going to have to grow our food differently. You know, we're not going to be able to transport it that far. The age of the 3,000-mile Caesar salad will be coming to an end. And so one of the main implications of this is that in the places where we still do have remaining good arable farmland around the metro areas and around the towns, we can't even afford to dedicate it anymore to suburban house building. So we're going to have to get serious about a new kind of productive landscape. And for the environmentalists out there, this is going to require quite a mental shift. You know, for one reason or another, and for better or for worse, the environmental movement has been unduly preoccupied with scenic and recreational issues. And the rural landscape is not just about scenic and recreational issues. You know, it's going to be increasingly about what is the relationship between the urban habitats of all scales and a productive farming habitat and ecology that has to be different from, you know, that is not just scenic and recreational. And that's going to be a big consideration for us.
You are listening to James Howard Kunstler speaking for the Urban Studies Program of Simon Fraser University, January 24, 2008.
Most of the delusional thinking that's floating around out there has tended to focus on the issue of alternative fuels and systems for running them. And I think that the truth of the matter is that no combination of alternative fuels or systems for doing them will permit us to live the way we're living, or even a substantial fraction of the way we're living. No combination of solar or wind or tidal or nuclear or biodiesel or ethanol or used French fried potato oil is going to allow us to keep Walmart and the interstate highway system and Walt Disney World running. We're going to try everything. We probably should try most of these things. But the bottom line is, we're going to be disappointed in what these things can do for us. And unfortunately, a lot of the delusional thinking that is out there really involves fantasies, grandiose fantasies about what technology is going to be able to do for us. And the conclusion that I think we must draw from this is that it can't be about running all this stuff by other means. It's got to be about making other arrangements comprehensively. We are going to use almost all these other things. But, for example, you know, we have a lot of fantasies about putting up giant wind farms all over North America. I don't believe we're going to do it. I think we'll put up some, but I think that what you're going to find out is that these things will be used on a household basis, on maybe a neighborhood basis or a district basis. But we're not going to be putting up that many of these giant wind farms, and we're going to run into another problem further down the road, because we're not only dealing with peak oil, we're dealing with peak metals, peak exotic alloys, peak materials needed for the fabrication of these wind tower, the turbines, which require very exotic materials and methods of fabrication that are expensive. So if we could do this stuff on a household and neighborhood basis, that's probably the scale that we need to think about. And remember what I said earlier. Behind all this is the issue of what is the appropriate scale for living, for everyday life in North America, or, you know, among civilized people. And many of the alt-fuel fantasies are about continuing to live at the wrong scale by other means, okay? And we're not going to be able to do that. This was an interesting utterance made in the wake of a great trauma, the 9/11 attack, when the people in the U.S. needed some psychological support. The trouble with it is that it doesn't comport with the way the universe works. Unfortunately, if you don't negotiate the circumstances that the universe sends at you, you get assigned a new negotiating partner named reality. And then it negotiates for you. You don't even have to be in the room anymore, you know. And that's really what's happening. You know, this is actually a belief that, you know, 90% of the people down in the United States actually subscribe to. And unfortunately, if they don't negotiate, then they're simply going to, you know, have to do what circumstances dictate that they must do. That they'll have to do what events compel them to do, and they'll have less and less to say about it the longer they stay out of the conversation. So, you know, there are some major obstacles to our ability to think coherently and to mount a public discussion about these issues that makes sense. And one of them is this. You know, in this media-saturated culture, it's now become normal for adults in North America to think that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. It's a nice thought for a six-year-old child, but it's not a good idea for most adults to believe this. You know, because among other things, you know, one of the hallmarks of being an adult is knowing the difference between wishing for stuff and making stuff happen. And a whole, you know, continent full of people who think that just wishing for stuff will make things happen, you know, are going to be very disappointed. It's accompanied by this other idea. Actually, this is America's newest and fastest growing religion, okay, which is not evangelical Christianity. It's the worship of unearned riches. And it's based on the theological idea that it's possible to get something for nothing. Now, that also is inconsistent with the way the universe works, but is now become a normative belief throughout most of adult America. So you combine these two, you know, what have become two normal ideas in America now, the idea that it's that when you wish upon a star, your dreams come true, and that when you wish upon a star, you'll get something for nothing. And that's where we're at with the alternative energy situation. We're all sitting around wishing to get something for nothing. And it's not going to happen. By the way, here they are at their devotions. And I saw a really interesting example of this about a year and a half ago. I was invited to give a talk at the Google headquarters in Silicon Valley. And I went down there, their headquarters are in an office park building in some jive plastic suburb in near San Jose somewhere. And it was really interesting. The whole building was tricked out like a kindergarten, okay? They had knock hockey sets and foosball games and ping pong and video game consoles, and they had the Lucite boxes with the gummy bears and the yogurt-covered pretzels. And, you know, it was the perfect kindergarten. And this is the highest level of corporate enterprise now in America, you know. And so I thought, oh, it's nice. They're very playful. Isn't that cute? And then we went into the auditorium, which was a much larger space than this even, and the Google executives and senior engineers came in, okay, and they were dressed like skateboard rats. You know, they had, like, sideways hats on. You know, their pants were, their ass crack was showing because their pants were falling down. Like, dude. I become addicted to that. Like, dude. And so, you know, I gave my spiel about energy, and at the time I was not talking about Google, right? Because, you know, I hadn't been there before, so I wasn't talking about it. And so I gave my spiel about energy, and, you know, we got a problem with energy, blah, 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 blah. And we did, like, comments and questions afterwards, and 17 guys got up afterwards, and there were no questions. They all made the same comment. And the comment was, like, dude, we've got technology. Subtext, you're an asshole. Case dismissed. But, you know, I soon realized what I was seeing, you know, was that I realized finally that, you know, all this juvenilia going on around me, I realized that, you know, these were the senior engineers and executives of Google. These were people who had become multi-millionaires, you know, at age 27. And they had accomplished it by moving pixels around a screen with a mouse. Okay, so that they had developed this grandiose delusion that all of the sorrows of mankind could be solved by pushing pixels around a screen with a mouse, you know? And the trouble with that is what it fundamentally meant was they really didn't know the difference between energy and technology. They thought that they were the same, you know, that you could substitute one for the other. If you run out of energy, dude, get some technology. Get an iPod. Listen to some tunes. And, you know, this is happening at the highest level of technological enterprise in America, okay? This wasn't the Acme Bowling Pin Company. This was the new economy. This was Silicon Valley. You know, this was the Brazilian dollar company. And so, you know, if they don't get it, you know, what if they don't get it at the highest level of American technology, who's going to get it, you know? So the delusional thinking is just amazing, you know? Okay. You know, go get 100,000 iPods, grind them up, and put them in there. And then we'll take off, okay? So we're going to run these things. Either we're going to run these things on the stuff they're used to running on, namely liquid hydrocarbon, you know, kerosene-like aviation fuel, or we're not going to have an aviation industry of the kind that we've been used to. And the prospect is that we're not. You know, we're not. And we can already see that's another one of the complex systems out there that's wobbling, and that is like looking like it's sooner or later is going to fail. And we're not going to change out the hardware, you know. We're either going to run the Boeing 707s and 37s and 57s and blah, 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 or and the Airbuses, et cetera, or we're not going to, these companies aren't going to run. Certainly not going to run the way we're running, they're running. So technology is not energy. And this, of course, is, you know, this is basically the fundamental idea that's lurking in the delusional mind is that there's some, you know, there's some group of meta scientists out there who are going to magically deliver all these rescue remedies to us, and that is not helpful. These ideas and these delusional thoughts are really being expressed most clearly in the salient theme that has emerged from this in the popular debate. In other words, the only thing that we're really talking about all across North America is how we're going to run the cars by other means, you know? And everybody's excited about it, you know? People come up to me after a talk and they say, dude, I got a Prius, you know? And they don't get it. It's not about, you know, the fact that the cars we're running are too big and too powerful. It's about the fact that we're running too many cars incessantly, okay, of all kinds. I don't care whether it's a Prius or a Cadillac Escalando or a Plymouth Inflicta. It doesn't really matter. But the important point is that we have to change this subject. And when you go to your cocktail parties, when you go to your dinner parties, meet with your friends, talk casually about the energy problem, if it comes up next time there's a gas hike or anything like that. You know, we got to start changing the subject and not just talk about how we're going to run the cars by biodiesel or, you know, use French fried potato oil. We got to start talking about making other arrangements for all of these complex systems that we depend on, not just the motoring. And these two can be, you know, we can form a comprehensive to-do list about all these things, that all these tasks that we face. Very clear, you know, at the upper right there, we're going to have to do agriculture different. You know, we have no idea how we're going to do this differently, but we're probably going to have to do it in smaller units, smaller farms, and it will probably require some amount more of human attention than it's getting now. Because we're going to be able to run fewer machines. You know, I don't know whether it's, you know, no machinery at all or 90% of the machinery we're running now. We really don't know, but it's going to change. We got to do it differently. And if there are additional social problems with land itself and with farmland itself that I'm going to go into a little later. The bottom right, we're going to have to do shopping differently. You know, we're going to have to rebuild those local networks of economic interdependency that were systematically destroyed by the way, with our permission completely, you know, that were destroyed by the Walmarts and the Target stores, et cetera. We don't know how we're going to rebuild these networks. Human societies tend to be self-organizing and emergent in response to the stuff that's happening and the circumstances of our times. And that's probably what will happen. But it is not necessarily going to be a smooth transition. We're going to have to do it whether we like it or not. The national chain stores are not going to survive the changes to their business equations, you know. And you can state, you know, pretty categorically what that means. The warehouse on wheels that Walmart uses to move all of its stuff around by, you know, putting all of its stuff in tractor-trailer trucks and circulating them incessantly around North America on the highways, okay? That is not going to work after a while. That's going to fail. So they're going to have problems with their 12,000-mile supply line to Asia where all the plastic salad shooters are coming from. We're going to have far fewer plastic salad shooters. Their customer base is going to have far less disposable income for buying this stuff. That's going to change too. So in many different directions and dimensions, they're going to become unstable and not be able to do business the way they've been accustomed to it. Okay, lower center. We're going to have to do school differently because the centralized school districts, the way they're set up, are going to get into a lot of trouble. We're going to have to make things differently. We have no idea how we're going to start manufacturing a lot of the stuff that we have outsourced again. Probably the answer is we're going to manufacture a whole lot less stuff and have a whole lot less stuff to buy, and that buying stuff is going to, you know, the blue light fiesta of shopping is now going to fade into the background of our lives. It's not going to be in the forefront of our lives anymore. And finally, we're going to have to occupy the terrain of North America differently than we have. And it will probably take the form of what has been called the new urbanism. Only the new urbanism is not going to be the new urbanism anymore. It's going to be the only urbanism. It's going to be traditional urbanism. Because that's really what the new urbanists did, was the great achievement of the new urbanists was not creating the new towns or the, you know, trying to accommodate the car and make it better, you know. Their real achievement was just diving into the dumpster of history and retrieving lost principle and methodology that had been thrown away by previous generations of professionals, the architects and the planners who tossed this stuff in the garbage in 1950 and decided, oh, we can just use statistical analysis and traffic engineering and everything will come out just great. And we see the result of that now all over North America in these horrible strip mall environments absolutely everywhere. What it probably means, really, is that we're going to have to return to traditional human environments, the kind we've had for the last, you know, 10,000 years, except for the period after World War II. And that means neighborhoods, villages, hamlets, towns, slightly bigger towns, small cities, some bigger cities, you know, and urban places, in short, and urban places that exist in a meaningful relationship with a surrounding productive agricultural landscape. And it's going to be very difficult because in many cases the agricultural landscape is now cluttered up with muffler shops and you know, subdivisions. But we are going to have to get back to that some way. I'll try to describe some ways we can do that. Now, you know, we're fortunate in this way in the East because we have a lot of the older fabric in those habitats that is scaled appropriately to what the future is going to require. You have a lot less of that in the west of North America, but there's quite a bit in Vancouver. In fact, a lot of the new stuff in Vancouver is actually appropriately scaled. So you're very fortunate here. What we have to do is actually emulate the best stuff that's appropriately scaled and consider that to be those things to be our models. We have no idea how we're going to do this. We may be using more animals, but, you know, I don't know whether it's 3% or 33% or 83%. We just don't know how this is going to happen yet. This diagram, I'm not fond of statistics or anything, but this is so striking. the amount of retail space that we have dedicated per person in the United States compared to other civilized countries, you know? And the conclusion to draw from this is we don't need another single silver souvenir spoon shop on this continent. You know, we are so over-retailed, it's not funny. And as an observer, I was standing watching a dead mall in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with a local guy from there a year or so ago. And we were just both sort of marveling at this. And he turned to me and he said, "I don't think we need that many evangelical roller rinks around here." No, we don't have any idea what we're going to do with this stuff. Most of it is probably not going to be reused. You know, we have a lot of fantasies that we're going to just reuse it. Actually, one of the things we're going to see is that we will have far fewer modular fabricated building materials to use. We're not going to be manufacturing as many, and probably at some point hardly any at all. And so a lot of this stuff is simply going to be disassembled for its value as either, you know, trusses, or just for the metal itself, or for the panels, or, you know, for one thing or another. Very little of it, I think, is going to be turned into, you know, we have fantasies that we're going to turn it into skateboard parks and things like that. Forget about it. I've already actually covered this. We have to rebuild those local networks of economic interdependency. One of the things that happened as a sort of a side consequence of losing that was, you know, we had these systems that not only provided economic roles for people in a locality, but also social roles that they played that combined. You know, they were integral to each other. They were woven together so that a person was a storekeeper, but he was also the employer of a local person. He also participated in the local decisions about his town. He or she generally owned two pieces of property in the town or the city, the place where they did business and the place that they lived. And they took care of these places. You know, they were the caretakers of the civic institutions. They sat on the boards of the library and the hospital and the, you know, they managed the Little League. You know, now in the States, if you want to have a Little League team, you have to apply to the state of New York for a grant because the people who supported those institutions are no longer in place in the social and retail network. In my part of the country, most of the factories in the Hudson and Mohawk Valley, which was a very dense industrial part of the United States, most of these factories are now being bulldozed. They're not even there anymore, even if we wanted to build stuff in them. The one thing that we have left in that part of the world is we have a lot of water power because we have rivers that move, that fall down, that have waterfalls, and we could generate a lot of power to actually have factories again. But it will probably be a matter of scale. You know, they're not going to be the same scale as the factories that evolved in 1910, 1920, as we ramped up the energy trail. Because now we're going down, and we're going to probably have to do it on a much more modest basis if we do it at all. You know, one of the more tragic focal points of the psychology of previous investment is in these centralized school districts. Because, you know, that's where the communities have really spent their money on these fabulous facilities, you know, with the gyms and the pools and the tracks and the, you know, acres and acres of parking and all the fabulous accommodations. They're probably going to fail. You know, we're not going to be able to keep hauling the kids around the 50-mile radius pupil sheds and collecting them every morning and then redistributing them in the afternoon. You know, but at the same time, we're going to be a far less affluent society because we, you know, at the same time, we're going to be going through what can be called pretty much a crisis of capital, including a crisis of having more investment money to do to fix this. And so I think what you'll see is that the next incarnation of schooling, in the United States anyway, is going to be probably homeschooling that will then aggregate into larger groups. You know, but we're not going to rebuild the schools and then distribute the smaller schools for the most part, you know, around the place where the people live. And then notice the quality of the schools that we built. You know, the in your upper right there, the Hannibal Lecter Central School. Because that's how we do it. You know, we build them like maximum security prisons. The Sierra Club has been there, notice. Thank you very much. That helps a lot. But we got to do better than that. We, you know, and it's also ironic. I mean, this is sort of a similar kind of thing as the phenomenon I described with the bankers all forgetting, you know, as a whole group, forgetting overnight that you have to have lending standards, okay? The educators forgot overnight that school buildings have to be dignified. You know, that kids need to feel okay about going into these places. They have to understand that school is a privileged activity and a wonderful privileged activity and not a punishment. And how we got the idea that school buildings should express the idea of punishment, it's really a remarkable thing that that's exactly what happened when, you know, just like the bankers became psychotic over their lending standards, the educators became psychotic over their architectural standards. So, you know, you begin to see the manifestations of a broadly psychotic culture. This is one of my pet peeves. It is very important to restore the North American railroad system. We have a railroad system that the Bolivians would be ashamed of. It's not good enough. We have to do better. There's no other project that we could do right away that it would have a bigger impact on our oil use. If we got to rebuilding it, we would create scores of thousands of jobs at every level, from labor to management, everything in between. It would benefit people in all ranks of society. It would have some other effects that would be very, very positive. One of the things you couldn't fail to notice, last summer, we were having the usual airport congestion miseries, you know, and President Bush got on the TV and said, oh, well, we're just going to regulate them more. You know, it never occurred to these idiots that if we could only run choo-choo trains between the cities that are 400 miles apart, you know, we could eliminate 27% of the flights that are coming out of the big airports, you know, plus the people would get there faster, you know, because they wouldn't spend the first hour taking their shoes off and, you know, having your belt taken away, you know, and getting to the airport an hour and a half early so you could take your shoes off after standing in line for an hour and a half, you know. So, but, you know, we're too dumb to get this. But it's very important that we do this. The infrastructure for rebuilding these things is out there rusting in the rain, and it doesn't require any new technology, okay? Now, there's a lot, as in all of the things I'm describing, there is an accompanying amount of grandiose fantasy, you know. So there are a lot of people around the country who want to do high-speed maglev rail, you know. But what I suggest is we learn how to do it on the Bolivian level first. And then if we pass our exam, then we can graduate to something more advanced, okay. And there's one final reason that this is very important. Because we need a confidence builder. We need a project that will build our confidence, that will make us feel okay and competent, and allow us to go on to do the other projects on that long list of tasks that we need to do. So we should get to that right away. There's no question that we're going to have to move stuff, at least more stuff, by rail and by water if we're going to move things at all around North America, because the whole truck thing is not going to be working for us very shortly. And the economics of this are self-evident. You know, trucks are the absolutely least efficient way for moving things around. You know, one of the problems for this, though, is that around the country we have been neglecting building port facilities, and especially in internally on the rivers and in the, you know, the internal continental system, so that we can move things around the center of the continent, not just across the oceans. And we need to rebuild the piers and the port facilities and the sleazy accommodations for the sailors and the warehouses and all of the accessories for maritime trade, which means for the planners, when you're faced with, you know, a project that's going up on a waterfront, ask yourself twice, you know, should we have condos here? Or do we actually need the infrastructure for maritime trade? Because we, in fact, we may. The long emergency is going to produce a lot of losers, a lot of economic losers, and they're going to be very ticked off. And a lot of them will be the formerly middle class, people who believe that they were entitled to a certain standard of living, and they're going to be very disappointed when it turns out not to be so. And it is probably going to lead to a certain amount of social turbulence. And, of course, another one of the psychological problems that we have is, you know, many, many people assume that there's a painless transition between where we're at now and where we're going. And I wouldn't make that assumption. In fact, I would assume that it's going to be difficult in one way or another. I think we could all agree that we would hope to minimize the political mischief involved, because that's about the last thing that you want to see happen is, you know, get into a really bad political situation. And I think that a lot of this stuff might actually revolve around the question of food production, because once people start, you know, being hungry, that's when you get into kind of revolutionary, uncharted territory. And when you get there, you immediately go down the path of the seizure of property and the seizure of land and the circulation of elites. And that will be a very, very dangerous place if we get to it. You know, I want to go back a minute because, you know, a lot of my friends sit around wringing their hands over George Bush. And he'll be gone soon. You know, whatever. I didn't vote for him, but I don't, you know, I don't lose a lot of energy over him, because what concerns me is what happens a little bit further down the road. You know, when we really get into trouble in this, in our two countries. And down in the United States, you know, I think that a picture is resolving that we have a nation of extremely passive and complacent entitled citizens who are going to be very ticked off as these things occur, and they're not going to know what to do. They're going to be paralyzed, and they're going to beg somebody to push them around. And, you know, that's the thing that worries me. It's not going to be George Bush. It'll be some corn-pone Nazi, you know, some Huckabee kind of guy. Those are the kinds of things that trouble my sleep. And so these things could start, you know, evolving into a dangerous revolutionary situation. The whole question of the city, I think, is very troublesome, and particularly here, because, you know, one of the kind of vexing things about Vancouver is, in many ways, you have done so many things well, given what you're working with, given the time, given the circumstances of this period. There are many things that you have done very well in the city itself. You know, not the least of which is just the basic condition of having a city that's alive, because most North American cities are not alive, and you have one that's alive. There are people on the street. It's an amazing thing, you know, for someone like me who comes from places like, you know, I go around to places like Houston and Dallas and Akron and Richmond, and, you know, there's no one there. You know, it's like the day the earth stood still. So the conventional thought about the future of the city is that it's only going to have more people in it, and more people are going to be coming. It's going to get bigger and bigger, and we're going to have to accommodate more people, and let's think along those lines. And I think what you're really going to see is that the cities are going to contract, because they simply won't be able to operate at the scale that we've experienced and that they've achieved in the last 50, you know, 75 years. Any way you cut it, they're going to have to contract. And the question really is only, how is that going to occur? And how much difficulty is it going to entail? And I think that, you know, my own version of it, which most people don't believe, they just don't believe it, and, you know, maybe their idea is more valid than mine. I really don't know. But my belief is that we're going to see a very stark reversal of the 200-year-long trend of people moving from the small towns and the farms to the big city, and that this is, in fact, going to reverse. You know, I mean, some trends, they just don't go on forever just because that's what you've experienced all of your life and your parents' life and your grandparents' life. Doesn't mean it's going to go on forever. I mean, for the life of us and our parents and our grandparents, we all had our lives during the rise of the industrial experience. You know, and now we're seeing the industrial experience really come to a kind of an inflection point. And I think that you're going to see these some of these major trends be different. I think you're going to see people going, having to leave the city for one reason or another. They can't get enough food. Food distribution breaks down. You know, we only have a three-day supply of food in most of North America, you know, in the just-in-time supply system that we've evolved to keep the supermarket shelves full of stuff. You know, that's how we do it. That's how it works. So there are any number of things that could make life in the cities really very difficult, very quickly, very suddenly. I think we're going to see eventually the cities are going to contract. They'll densify at their centers and in the appropriate places, that maybe the nodes around the centers and the waterfronts, and then all the stuff in the asteroid belt around is going to be really, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what the destiny of that stuff is. It may never be fixed. It may never retain its value. Some of it may become slums. Some of it may become salvage. Some of it may be ruins. We don't know. But that's my, you know, and when you look at these pictures of, you know, of yesterday's tomorrow, of the fantasies of what the city of tomorrow was going to be in 1911 or 1939, you know, they only thought, oh, they'll get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. The funny thing is about the 1939 one, you know, 25 years later, the cities in North America looked like Dresden after the firebombing, and we didn't even have a war here. Okay, so their fantasies were so far off from the way reality played out. It wasn't funny. So what is the appropriate scale of the city going to be? I think that the most successful urban places are going to be the smaller towns and the smaller cities, and that eventually the stuff that we rebuild and the stuff that we develop from a certain point on is going to have to be fairly modest, is going to have to take form within a different increment of development than we're used to, not the 100-acre project, not the $300 million project, because we're not going to have that kind of financing. We're going to have a lot less capital. You know, not the mega structure, not the skyscraper, but buildings that are scaled to the appropriate energy diet that we're on. Probably buildings built out of materials found in nature in the region that you're in. You know, not aluminum panels with turquoise enamel baked onto them. You know, maybe more like limestone or granite or, you know, whatever you, else you've got in your part of the world. And if we're lucky, you know, we will be able to actually create wonderful places. There's absolutely no reason why we can't have wonderful places. And by the way, you know, you don't need skyscrapers to have great places. Most of the great central cities in Europe are made out of buildings that are not more than about 6-7 stories high. And, you know, nobody goes around Paris complaining that it lacks cosmopolitan verve because it doesn't have skyscrapers in the center of the city, you know? We'll be lucky if we can achieve that, and it may actually result in a much more rewarding, more satisfying, walkable, human-scaled, humanistic urban organism. We may regain our understanding of what it means to create places that are worth being in. You know, in the new world, the public realm comes mostly in the form of the street. You know, we don't have that many cathedral market squares or, you know, deliberately created public places. Mostly public places in the form of the street. And that's one of the reasons that the new suburbs in Surrey are so unsatisfying is because the streets have been designed with so little thought and care. And they're so poorly detailed. But the street is the main public place. And we have forgotten that the public realm really has to function like an outdoor public room. And we need buildings that express our humanity through languages and vocabularies and grammars and rhythms and patterns that evoke something meaningful for us, not just, you know, sheer glass plates. You know, that's one of the reasons that architecture existed in the first place, was to inform us about who we are and where we've come from. Because, you know, it's not enough to just be oriented geographically in your town. You need to know also, you know, chronologically and historically and culturally where you've come from, and to be informed about who you are by the artifacts in your everyday world. And we did that in the United States. We happened to use a lot of Greco-Roman architecture, which eventually became called neoclassicism, you know. And we did it partly for symbolic reasons, to inform ourselves that we were democratic, you know, that we had something in common with ancient Greece, or that we were republic. We were a republic. We had something in common with Rome at its best. And so we employed these vocabularies for telling, informing us about that. You know, we used the devices of civic design. We had this whole body of culture called civic design, which was understood by almost everybody, you know, who was even just basically literate in our culture. It was in the hard drive of the culture. It was what was thrown in the garbage in 1950. But we used to understand this in things like, you know, the hotel veranda, a device of architecture and urbanism. You know, we knew what it was for. And it was only incidentally, by the way, only incidentally there for socializing. It was primarily there to denote very clearly a transition between the public place and the private place, and to make that transition, to lubricate your transition between those two things. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, when you're on Georgia Street in downtown Vancouver and you're faced with a sheer glass wall, you know, why it just doesn't feel as comfortable as having some kind of transitional device to go through to enter a building in, you know. But we really don't pay attention to these things. By the way, the portico on the hotel would function exactly the same way on a private house. You know, it's there in the private house for the same reason, to denote the transition between where the private realm of the house begins and the public realm of the outdoor and the street begins. So we used to be pretty good at this, and the result of doing this properly, of defining space well, using the facades of buildings, was something we had a great deal of skill in, and we forgot how to do this. So it resulted in places that were unquestionably worth caring about. There was no argument about whether these places were worth caring about or not. You know, there were no style arguments about this, because this isn't a matter of style. It's a matter of knowing how to design and assemble places that are worthy of our affection, worth caring about. And what we've done all over this continent for the last 50 years is create one place after another that's not worth caring about. And when you have enough of them, you end up with a nation that's not worth defending, or a culture that's not worth carrying forward. And that's unfortunately where we're at. And, you know, we can't afford this kind of attitude anymore. You know, I once wrote in one of my own books that it's the unfortunate destiny of the ridiculous to be ridiculed. It's in the nature of it, you know, and we can't afford to be these kinds of clowns. You know, we have to do better. The time for being a clown culture is over. And the time even for being ironic about being part of a clown culture is over. In fact, one of the things that we're going to leave behind is this whole idea of the generalized pervasive irony that afflicts us. You know, the idea that the fact that we're ridiculous is cool because we can laugh at it. You know, it's not cool to be ridiculous. And it's not cool to be clowns and to be ineffectual. It's cool to be people who can make things happen and to know the difference between wishing for stuff and making things happen. When I go around to the colleges, I'm almost always asked, can't you give us any hope? Well, first the students say, can't you give us some solutions? And I want to remind you, I'm not going to give you rescue remedies, but I've given you a comprehensive to-do list of things that we got to do to get our acts together. You know, we're going to have to rebuild, reform, and fix these complex systems, the way we do shopping and trade and manufacturing, the way we do farming, the way we do transportation, the way we inhabit the landscape, the way we do finance and banking. All of these things have to be rescaled and fixed and reformed for this new era we're entering. And we don't have any time to be crybabies and hand-wringers and for feeling sorry for ourselves and all that. We got too much to do. But the other question that the students always say is, can't you give us hope? Can't you give us hope? And it always reminds me of, you know, my adventures in the 90s, going around to the urban design conferences, you know, the urban conferences. And I went to one at Yale on the future of the American city. And it was in about 1994 or 5, in the ascendancy of political correctness, you know. And all of the professors were all jockeying for advancement. And so they were all, buttering each other up to show how compassionate they were. And so one after another, they got up and said, oh, we must give self-esteem to the poor people in the cities. And, you know, this went on for like 4 hours. Then, I had my little turn and I said, we must give cocaine to all the people in the cities. Why? Because it makes you feel great about yourself without accomplishing anything. So hopefully we're beyond that now, and, you know, we're beyond that kind of the kind of therapeutic bullshit that my generation, you know, created as the basis for understanding the world. You know, we're hopefully getting beyond that to living in a reality-based world. But part of that reality is the following fact, that you are the generators of hope. No one's going to give you hope in a little basket. You generate your own hope by demonstrating to yourself that you're a capable person, that you know that you're an adult who knows the difference between wishing for stuff and making things happen, who doesn't expect to get something for nothing, who's willing to go out and put your shoulder to the wheel and take care of your society. And that's how you generate hope, by proving you're a competent person. So that's how it's done. I want to do a little advertisement for my forthcoming book as a kind of a thought exercise. I decided that I wanted to write a novel about the post-oil experience. And so this book is coming out in March. It's a novel set in the post-petroleum United States, and it's a ripping yarn. So I hope that you'll be interested in it. It'll be in the bookstores soon. Thanks a lot. Thank you very much.
This speech by James Howard Kunstler was as the first visiting professor to the Simon Fraser University Urban Studies program. Kunstler's homepage is simply kunstler.com, spelled KUNSTLER.com. Watch for his new novel about life in America after the oil age, titled World Made by Hand. That's coming out in March. The Vancouver lecture was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Find Mr. Kunstler's presentation at our website at ecoshock.org on the Peak Oil page. I'd like to thank Mr. Kunstler, his publishers, and Simon Fraser University for permission to record this speech for nonprofit, college, and community radio stations.
You can download this program to share with others from the archive at the Unwelcome Guests website, unwelcomeguests.org. Thank you for listening.
Come down like a